secure agreements from the parties to this merger that will allow the FTC to allow us access to what's going on. And to make all the studies and reports that you have at your disposal available to us so that we can also make our best recommendation to you. It's been said that a people elects the government it deserves. If Tony Knowles does not act to protect Alaska's interests, Backbone asks that you work with us and the people of Alaska to prove we deserve better. Thank you.
Thank you. Question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. The first, you mentioned moving too quickly. I don't know what that means. What raises your concern with regard to moving too quickly?
We've heard that the timeline on this, on these negotiations with the FTC is very short. We've heard dates quoted such as October 1st to October 15th being the finalization of the recommendations by the FTC. It's not clear to us that this is enough time for the FTC or for all of us to really understand what the issues are here and what recommendations should be made. We think that we should take as much time as we have to, as much time as we can, to really understand what we're up to.
Thank you. The other question is this. I don't want to politicize this process as a political question. Feel free not to answer it. You seem to differentiate the Attorney General and the Governor. Do you have a basis for that?
I don't think so, Jim. Not a factual basis. But I have had indications from members of our committee that the Governor may not be going in the right direction in terms of some of the opinion of some of the team or the administration.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just another question, and we've discussed this before, but, you know, your tree request, of course, this committee can't appropriate anything until we're back in session. And I know you understand that. One of the things that we had thought of was to at least ask the administration should they need any money if an antitrust action is to be filed. Your other two points deal with information and access to information. And, of course, that's taken up a great deal of our time in trying to gather this, and I was glad that the FTC Director of Competition was here to say it for us as well, that in order to get the information, you have to agree to the confidentiality of the information. And, you know, we are in a catch-22 if we're trying to respond. I absolutely recognize and agree with your position in wanting the information to be public. I, in part, agree with the companies, at least with regard to business plans, not being public. Mm-hmm. But it is the strangest process in the 21 years that I've been involved in politics directly. It's the strangest process that I've had to participate in, because it seems that you're caught on confidentiality. One way or the other, you can't possibly get the information, or you can't share the information. And it is just a frustrating position to be in. I don't know if you have any enforceable solutions or suggestions, but if you do, I'd love to hear them.
Okay. We'll keep looking for them.
If there's no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Steve Kahn.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Steve Kahn. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Public Interest Research Group. We are also a member of the Backbone Coalition, wrestling with what appears to be perhaps the most significant public policy question in Alaskan history. Significant because, as I said in previous testimony, suggested to you in previous testimony, that if one examines the history of why it is Alaska became a state, it appears that our preeminent concern was that we achieve sovereignty and that those who drafted the Alaska Constitution, including the provision on natural resources, well understood and were guided to understand by Representative Bartlett at that time in the keynote address, that at the crux of political sovereignty was economic sovereignty, an ability to guide one's destiny through some level of control of one's natural resources. The founders of the state understood, of course, then, as you understand now, that a state that lives and dies on its ability to guide and control the exportation of a natural resource exists within a larger world, a world inhabited by multinational companies who play the entire landscape of the earth as a piano, and a world guided by markets that are also well out of our control. So the leverage advocated at that time, the leverage advocated to this day, is competition and a true free market to the degree that a single state can guide public policy toward that end. Our situation then is endangered because what the component of sovereignty most important to real sovereignty rather than the pretense of sovereignty that we can see all over the world in many of the post-colonial nations, quote-unquote nations, is the presence or absence of economic sovereignty. That is to say, if one does not guide that component, one is guided. The political structure, the political landscape, the ability of each of you to advocate and carry through public policy decisions is then no more than a puppet show, a stage, a pretense, a facade. Now, some of you and I have been in the past engaged in political debate over many things and at odds, at loggerheads over those debates. But consistently and persistently, we who are in the minority, the political minority, are supportive of you in the majority and your ability to make true decisions based on our self-interest as you and those who elect you perceive them to be. So in this situation, we stand with you, concerned about your ability to be a true statesperson for us. In this context, can we look to the FTC to support our economic sovereignty? I think the answer, and I'm sorry to be so pessimistic, is no, because we, in this day and age, it is very unlikely that the FTC will fall back on its earlier history and take our side in an issue that ultimately defines our destiny rather than the world's destiny. Globalization has brought this into play. Whether they will perceive upstream control, the upstream control that we're only too aware of the economics of oil production, refinement, and distribution in our state as significant as the downstream control of, let us say, filling stations or things immediately affecting the consumers in California is an open question, but I would suggest that they are not likely to do so. So they may come, they may go, they may do their dance and their procedure, but at the end of the day, if anyone is to protect our economic sovereignty, now and in the future, it is to be you. It is to be you, the body politic, those of us that we have, that the majority has selected to lead us in this generation. I endorse the position of the backbone people in the sense that I think that the initiative now falls to the legislature to press forward for funds sufficient and for an antitrust action, a serious antitrust action, and one that through the process of discovery would press for release of documents necessary to an honest evaluation of our situation, our economic sovereignty. I say a serious action because I think a company of sophistication as is BP will well perceive a mock action, a legal action, and distinguish it from a serious action. Do we have any sense of how the life with BP as our guiding economic sovereign, do we have a sense of how it will be? In my estimation, we already do. We see an example of manipulation of public policy occurring alongside of this very serious question. If we look back a tad, we see British Petroleum defining what we now come to almost unanimously believe is our fiscal crisis by underwriting university research that seemed as a part of its very nature to exclude a reexamination of oil taxation from the paradigm. Out of that, we see a proposal emerging from the legislature that seeks advice from the public as to whether or not it is now time to focus first and foremost on our use of our permanent fund resources as a source of public funding. I would suggest to you, even those of you, and I'm sure many of you are, supportive of a yes vote in that process, that we are watching a very sophisticated multinational oil company work its will on our body politic even before a merger has occurred. A very bad sign for Alaskan's future. I am suggesting to you that what we are seeing in that initiative is an attempt to achieve a backdoor tax protection for British Petroleum. One, I would encourage you as a committee, and even those of you who seek a yes vote in that vote as part of your general concern, inquiry, to seek to find out to what degree British Petroleum, directly or indirectly, is underwriting the campaign, the $1 million campaign, in favor of that vote. Perhaps they are on, quote unquote, your side at this moment, but I can assure you the day will come where they will be on the other side. And if they are prepared, either directly or indirectly, to manipulate our public policy on a salient issue, certainly a critical issue that you would all agree is a critical issue, by funding directly or indirectly, let us say, I might suggest, through funding other business and industry alliance concerns, a backdoor tax device for tax protection, then this bodes ill for the state, for its economic sovereignty. Now, is that a matter of confidentiality that cannot be breached as you examine this? In my opinion, you are entitled to have access to that information and to ask British Petroleum how it is they are spending their political dollar on our political landscape. You do, after all, want to know how they will perform in the future as a corporate citizen in our state. That is an issue of moment, and I hope you will take a look at it alongside of the issues that have been discussed today. I have every confidence that each of you, whatever your political position on that issue, on issues that we will debate in the future, do understand that believe that your ability to guide and your role as a political leader is very much a part of this consideration of the pros and cons of the BP-ARCO merger. Please focus on that. for this generation and for the generations that follow. We are at a crossroads in Alaska, and I hope that that component of this, the historical component, the reason that you have chosen to devote much of your life to political careers is of moment today as we enter the new century. And I thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you. Questions by members of the committee? If not, Jim Sykes.
Thank you, Senator Halford, members of the committee, for allowing me the opportunity to speak here this afternoon. Professor Kahn is a tough act to follow. He's raised some very valid points, but I do believe the reason that we're here today is the very question of whether Alaska can control British Petroleum or whether British Petroleum will control Alaska. As I hope you've received a report which Oil Watch Alaska, which I represent, a group of citizens who believe in openness, fairness, and accuracy, monitoring the oil industry and government, released a report called The Big Squeeze, demonstrating how competition has been eliminated on the North Slope. If you look at the history of the industry, the promises of things that have been brought to the legislature to increase competition have, for the most part, had the reverse effect. They have eliminated competition. In terms of the Federal Trade Commission, and speaking with them earlier today, about 1% of their cases ever go to court. So if the state of Alaska wants to have an effect on this process and analyzing it and deciding what is best for the citizens of Alaska, it has to happen soon, and the state has to take the lead. Because if you look at the mergers that the FTC has considered in recent years, there haven't been very many that they haven't liked or haven't given their stamp of approval. And their process is one, when they find difficulties with a merger, they go to the parties and try to negotiate the problems away. They only go to court as a last resort. So I do support Backbone's request to make an appropriation of $5 million. And if the governor is going to call a special session, you might, as long as you're down in Juneau, call your own special session with your own agenda to consider this, because we do understand that the companies may want to wrap this up in September or early October, and that's not a lot of time to consider something that may be the most serious challenge to our statehood structure and our economic and political sovereignty that we have ever faced. I have a few specific recommendations that you may wish to consider. Right now, our entire leasing, royalty, and tax system is based on competition. There is a mountain of evidence, and we can help provide some of the details of that, that this will eliminate competition. The state cannot react soon enough to deal with a company that has entrenched itself as the controller of our source of oil and the majority of our leases and the control of our oil transportation system over land and marine. The state cannot soon enough deal with changing the structure to a non-competitive environment. But you could do some things during a special session. I would suggest that the legislature consider emergency powers to deal with a non-competitive environment. One power might be to return to separate accounting, to consider how much BP spends in Alaska, makes in Alaska in profit, and tax them separately from their worldwide profits. Two, to consider public ownership of TAPS, which was a proposal by Richard Feinberg, endorsed by both Alaska Public Interest Group and Oil Watch Alaska. Under those emergency regulations, I would encourage you to consider taking back the leases in excess of the amount which BP would be legally entitled to hold if a merger were to take place. By that, I mean the state needs to empower itself to decide which leases it will take, not allow BP the choice of which leases they want to keep.
Just on that point,
on the day before the merger occurs, don't they have the constitutional right to give us back what they choose?
I'm not sure that's clear. Right. It appears that that is the case.
Okay.
But I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not an expert in this area. One thing that the state needs to do, and it hasn't been done for a long time, is analyze the profitability. During the past half dozen years, oil and gas lifting costs have been cut by more than 50%, and the result has been skyrocketing corporate profits, and we get the same old royalty. We're not sharing in the technological developments which make oil more profitable here in Alaska. And if you consider in 1998 dollars, the $100 or so billion in net profit that has been made by the oil industry in Alaska, approximately half of that has been made by BP. If you then consider how important Alaska was to BP's profitability 2 years ago, we were a major portion of that, probably 45% of BP's profitability of their worldwide corporation. When they merged with Amoco, we went down to about 33 or 34%. Now with ARCO, you would think, well, this will give Alaska more emphasis. But ARCO has other holdings in the world. It actually puts us down to about one quarter, 25 or 26% of the worldwide holdings. So when a corporation is trying to perform its best for its shareholders, they're going to look at the worldwide picture. And Sir John Brown said so on television just last week, that they're going to cut their operations in marginal places. They're going to sell off capital that they don't need, and they're going to fire people that they don't need to employ. I think that's a warning for Alaska that we stand to become a backwater of oil development if BP is allowed to decide when they're going to develop our oil or gas or maybe never. And it goes back to the warning that was given to the Constitutional Convention. When a single entity has large sectors of public land under lease or under their control, then we are at their mercy, literally. There may be other things you may wish to consider. Some other oil-producing regions automatically own 51% of anything a corporation does in their area. That would be a pretty effective veto power if we didn't like what they wanted to do. That'd be a pretty major step for this state, I grant. But you need to explore the options available to you, including contracting out our extraction and distribution of oil. One of the problems that I see with a potential merger, if you look at the whole West Coast, if they have the oil supply and the transportation, and they own the refining and the distribution, a large sector of it on the West Coast, even if we did at some future point have some competition, our competition might not be able to enter the West Coast market to refine or distribute the downstream products that might come from Alaska. And while it's a worldwide market, we would be forced to find other markets to send our oil. So I believe this is a disaster. In terms of the confidentiality issue that you raised, Senator Halford, I believe I asked this issue to the FTC staff this morning, and they said the state is free to release information, although I understand that you're gathering information that you've guaranteed confidentiality on. The state still has the authority and the power to ask the parties to release it to the public. And if there's some information the public needs to know that the oil companies in this merger don't want to release, I don't think that you should stop yourself from saying, we have requested this information, which we think is very important to the public, and they have denied access to it for the public. Because we want to see some sunshine on this, because it's an issue for Alaskans. And if you do get concessions, you have to have the authority to enforce them. And right now, we don't have a large number of enforcers for the laws that we already have on the books. And there's an entire book written about BP's broken promises to Alaskans, to Alaskans and some of the regulations. So I won't dwell on it anymore, but I do hope that you can appropriate, that you can encourage the Attorney General to file a lawsuit in either state or federal court, because a lawsuit also is a method of bringing some of the documents that may be confidential to public view, and those documents may need to be considered. But I find the schedule of this merger takeover frightening, and I urge you all do speed, and anything that we can do to provide some details or provide you some avenues of information that would help you do that, we would be happy to do.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The next person signed up to testify is Harold Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for having on a coat and tie. I only wear them about twice a month now, and you just happened to catch me on that day. I don't think there's any special significance. Maybe I wore it out of respect to you all. I've given you my written remarks here. For the record, my name is Harold Hines. I'm a 30-year resident of Alaska. In the 1980s, I was president of ARCO Alaska and president of ARCO Transportation Company. In the early 90s, I was Commissioner of Natural Resources for Governor Hickel. I currently do consulting work, and right now one of my clients is Otna, Inc. But I'm here today as a private citizen to offer my personal perspective on what I think the legislature should do in regard to the BP-AMECO merger of ARCO. Now, there's several parts to my perspective, and they interweave, so sort of bear with me. Number one, I want you to understand that the loss of ARCO in the Alaskan oil industry is something that I don't particularly like. It certainly damages my own feelings of identity to know that the enterprise I spent a career with is no more. I have a great deal of empathy for the upheaval and uncertainty that the current employees of both ARCO and BP in Alaska will face for a period of several months. But regardless of those negative feelings, my conclusion is that it is best that the merger go forward. Rather than fearing the merged BP-AMECO company bolstered with ARCO's Alaskan people and assets, I believe that the state of Alaska has an opportunity to forge an enhanced future for North Slope oil development. The small reduction of competitive momentum in Alaska is more than offset by the greatly strengthened competitive position of Alaska in the international oil industry. The approach that I see many people taking in reaction to the merger is far too negative, and its bitter rhetoric leaves no basis for positive relationship. I don't believe that establishing a confrontational relationship with a major segment in the Alaskan economy does anyone good. There is a real danger that some will use the debate of, quote, merger conditions to erect barriers to oil development, the very oil development that has been and will continue to be in the very best interest of the Alaskan people. Not to say there aren't issues related to the state of Alaska's interests, but I've taken some time to think it through, and my evaluation is that the real, quote, threats are limited in number and manageable through existing mechanisms and agencies. For example, it's clear that Alaska loses when an economic oil field development project is either delayed or not undertaken. If, and I'll underline if, that became an issue in the future, I think you'll find that the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission has sufficient authority legally to spotlight and correct that abuse. I'm also a strong believer that if any real abuses, as different from some of the conjured up things I've read, do occur, the public opinion reaction would be strong, and I believe that BP-AMECO knows that its best interest aligns with the Alaskan public interest. So finally, my recommendation. As I remember the Alaskan State Constitution, it assigns the formulation of resource development policy to the legislature, and I think you should. I think it's appropriate that this committee focus on defining and enunciating Alaska's development expectations and then communicate those directly and publicly to BP's executive management in Alaska and London. A side effect of that effort will be a definition of ways to assure that this vision remains in front of all Alaskans and is publicly accountable on an ongoing basis. I kept my remarks short. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to expand on any point.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Hines. I think it's important to ask one question here. While on that excursion to London. What if we find that while in London, BP disagrees with that which we think is in the best interest of Alaska?
I just don't see that happening. I believe that if Alaska defines what is in its very best interest, and if this committee's hearings were devoted to that issue, I would be happy to participate again in the future. I'm sure there's a lot of other people. Once that expectation is enunciated, I think it can be very clearly communicated to them, and that becomes the rules of the game here in Alaska.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next up is Vic Fisher.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Vic Fisher. I appeared before this committee last time, and the main thrust of my remarks was we've got to get information out to the public, that the people have to know what is being done, what is contemplated, that any agreements, any conditions are put before the public. I noticed that we're being surrounded these days by a barrage of soft ads designed to sort of lull Alaskans to sleep. And that bothers me, especially sort of the implication that BP was part of statehood and it's been with us for 40 years and so on. I respect BP tremendously. I think they've done a phenomenal job in developing the North Slope. So has ARCO. And this is what I'm bothered about. What I would like to suggest to the committee, I think Harold had some good comments, but I would like the committee to lean on the governor, on the executive branch, and have presented to you in public the conclusions of the various task forces appointed to study the different aspects of the proposed BP takeover of ARCO. As was pointed out earlier, there's some very good people on those committees. The information that I think needs to go before the public has nothing to do with confidentiality. I don't think anybody needs to know, wants to know, the internal business mechanics of ARCO, of BP, of what the merger means in terms of profitability. What we need to do is to have these task forces that are specifically designed to look at the environmental impacts of transportation and whatever those task forces are, to bring the general conclusions, the, you might say, the public interest aspects before the public. And that is, I hope, where your committee will go. Thank you.
I think that's a good suggestion. And the conclusions, of course, are not the confidential data upon which they're based. Further questions?
Just a comment. I think this committee has subpoena powers that may be appropriate in that regard.
Good luck, Mr. Chairman.
Next is Barbara Williams.
Well, this is my daughter, and this is one of the things I want to speak about while I'm here. This merger obviously affects our children, and this is one of my children that this will affect, because this is her future. And one of the things that we're looking at doing is playing with our permanent funds. And our children receive those permanent funds, but it's not been made clear to us as families in this community if our children have a say in this. They pay taxes on their permanent funds. And they should have a say in this, too, or their say should be proxied to their parents, because this affects all of us, and it affects their futures. and we don't believe that our permanent fund should be monkeyed with. We also would like to speak to you today about workers. I represent a lot of injured workers in this state, and I'm looking for a public commitment from BP ARCO here to continue their level of contributions to community services in our community. If these two entities merge, there will be a lot less of available to give to communities and for people that need to provide services to families in our communities. And this is one of the major donors here, that, and they provide a lot of funds to the United Way and things like that. We want to see that these funds and these contributions remain high and continue for smaller organizations such as myself that provide free services to people that have work in the oil fields. If these people are injured on the job or need services, if they are chemically injured, there are no doctors here to treat those individuals, and they have to be flown outside, which creates a lot of headache and havoc for them, because if nobody knows what's wrong with you, obviously you're malingering in the system. And we would like a public commitment from the BP Foundation that their level of giving will remain high and that they're committed to these smaller organizations in the communities that look out for workers. And we want to make sure that our workers are protected and not not caught up in this. We want to make sure that this is not driven by a political agenda, as some of our other things are. If they're allowed to control all this, we want to see that the people have a say in this, because the people are the victims in this instance, and many of them cannot seek medical care because they have been chemically injured on the job, and because no one knows what's wrong with them, they're unable to seek medical treatment right now. And I have five people on a list that could die without proper medical care, and we are providing free services to get them out to the medical care they need. And we are a nonprofit organization. We're a grassroots organization. And we're looking for funding from people just like BP Foundation and other sources in our communities. We help people find food, housing, clothes. We help them seek physician services. We help them get outside to seek medical treatment for free. And so we feel that this is would be a very big impact on these people if we're unable to help provide services for them when they're injured and hurt on the job.
What's the name of your organization?
My name of the organization is the Alaska Injured Workers Alliance, and we work in this community with the community action groups on toxics, the Conservation Foundation, and things like that, to get awareness out in the different communities about toxins and things that are going wrong in our environment. Because if you are a person that works in the oil sector, you very well know that there are a lot of things that these folks could be exposed to. And these workers are also encouraged not to report on-the-job injuries because of bonus programs and packages that are available to them. So we get a lot of people that cannot find legal services to litigate their claims, because there are 10 attorneys for 30,000 claims statewide, so there are no attorneys for them. We are the only source of support and help for these workers. So we would like to be able to continue our efforts. Plus, we'd like to protect our kids' future.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for your testimony.
So would it be out of line here to ask somebody, one of these people here that might be from BP, will you continue to commit to a level of giving at this particular point, or will it just be something that will be floating out in the air not answered?
Well, obviously, we don't have them here to answer it right now, but we do have a statement by, I think, BP or possibly by BP ARCO combined that said, as I believe, that their giving to all those causes would equal the combined total of the two in the past. So I think that statement has already been made. I'll go back and look at my file of what the public statements were. I think that statement has been made. Whether that statement is followed is, you know, up to people to pursue. But I think the statement's been made. It's been made in writing.
Well, we were just really wanting to follow up on that, because we know how many services we are providing for people in these communities, especially the toxic and chemically injured workers. And so we were looking for these people, because we have not seen any giving from them, and we know that what these workers are having to go through to get treatment. And so we're looking for that commitment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nick Begich.
Senator Halford and members of the committee, I thank you for the opportunity to speak to this issue, and I also agree that this is probably one of the most important issues facing Alaska in the coming years. And for a number of years, actually, I've had the opportunity to start to think about, you know, what would happen if, and there's really two kinds of oil companies. There's a multinational oil company, and there's government oil companies. And virtually every third world country reaches a point in their development, and Alaska can be equated in many instances to those third world countries, where they have to ask themselves the question, is it time for us to produce our own oil? Are we getting a fair deal from the industry that's here, really representing their stockholders' interests first and foremost, regardless of anything that a corporate officer might want to pass on to the residents of this state? The idea of going to London and maybe getting a debate, I think we've had those debates on tax questions in the past where we've given up billions of dollars to our partners when most prudent businessmen with those kinds of problems with partners would be looking for new ones. The issue of what would happen if Alaska bought the assets of ARCO, first of all, those assets have a value that can be readily defined by the offer made by BP, and they can be segregated from their international and other lower 48 interests, and a value could be defined. That would give Alaskans, instead of 12.5% of the oil, less than a sharecropper's share in the south going through the pipeline, it would give Alaskans their 12.5% and approximately 40% that ARCO Alaska would have rolling through that pipeline. The fees collected for the transportation would also be offsetting the expenditure of buying those Alaskan assets. And if you think about it, and actually I think if you costed it out, it wouldn't take very many years for the transportation charges to add up to the cost of that acquisition, given that the value has already been defined. The possibility of doing that, either through the Alaska Industrial Development Fund or perhaps putting an option on the ballot for voters to look at. Instead of talking about decreasing permanent funds, we'd then be talking about what will happen to the permanent fund over 10 years of 52% of North Slope oil rolling into that pipeline. We can talk then about Alaskan hire and what that means when Alaskans control the oil that's being produced in the state. In competition between private and public, let it happen. Let BP compete for those resources against an Alaskan-owned company operated by Alaskans with strictly Alaskans' interest at heart and not corporate interests in the background. I think if it were costed out, if it were analyzed against what's being proposed, I think there'd be distinct advantages. The revenue streams for this state would significantly increase. The possibility of enhancing what this state has. I mean, the idea that overseas in places much more politically unstable than this state, certainly, and there's investments, commitments of billions and billions of dollars, and up to 50% royalties in many instances. And yet, here we have a safe place. So what will happen with our resources when 70% are controlled by one company? Will they be set in reserve? Will they exploit places that are easy to exploit in terms of environmental protections and other protections, and leverage us every time we turn around with the statement, hey, if the tax situation changes, we might have to leave? Well, maybe Alaska's in a position to produce its own resources, and maybe this is the time to start considering that as an option, and maybe that will give us the best leverage for negotiating the best deal for Alaskans and not for ARCO and BP. The idea of people coming here and arguing about the crumbs that fall from the table of the oil industry in terms of handouts isn't the position Alaskans should be in negotiating for the fundamental resources. If you look at the Constitution, which Vic Fisher was certainly a part of drafting, it's to develop the resources for the benefit of Alaskans, for the highest benefit to Alaskans. The oil isn't theirs. The oil belongs to us first. And we decide and we dictate what happens to that oil, not someone in London, who historically has a history that certainly leads us to question whether or not there's going to be the total disclosures and integrity. The idea that we're going to rely on the Federal Trade Commission, the federal government, to cut a good deal for Alaskans, when they're already diminishing the deal they made with us under statehood in terms of our royalty shares to open up ANWR, to open up the Naval Petroleum Reserve, I think is a ridiculous assumption that we're going to be protected by the federal government. It's up to Alaskans, it's up to you as elected officers representing this state to make sure that we get the best for Alaskans.
look at an acquisition as an alternative. Look and cost that out. Appropriate the money to do that, and let's see which deal measures up for Alaskans and which one will deliver to Alaskans what we're entitled to, not a sharecropper share. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Amen. Thank you. Questions? If there's no questions, Richard Feinberg. Now, the first time he checked, he didn't want to say something, but then he put an X and said he did, and I know he does. Richard.
Good deal of paperwork in the last 6 weeks. I did not bring that paperwork forward for the moment. Thank you for your patience and for the opportunity to speak. On June 11th, I testified to you that the state should consider acquisition of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline as a condition of the proposed merger. My premise, reinforced by data developed since that time, was that unless the pipeline is operated by an entity that does not have production interests on the North Slope, we cannot reasonably expect companies other than BP to make significant contributions to future North Slope development. I renew that recommendation today based on four pieces of information that have emerged since June 11th. The first is that I've learned through the request of one of your members that the pipeline tariffs in 1998 and 1999 show very little sign of the competition promised by the 1997 amended capacity settlement agreement, and they do not show the benefits of reduced tariffs on the order of those achievable through state acquisition of the pipeline. See table number 2 of my June 11th testimony and my July 21 memorandum to the chair. I have also reviewed updates of the previous analyses of collections under the 1985 TAPS settlement agreement for the dismantling of the pipeline. I want to summarize those results because I've heard some confusion and the press has misreported what I had clearly summarized in my report in some places. I concluded that the $1.535 billion collected through 1998 has an imputed value today of $4.5 to $4.9 billion versus expected dismantling costs on the same basis of $2.3 billion. In other words, the TAPS owners have made a tremendous killing on an environmental requirement portrayed in the 1985 settlement as a non-profit item. You have the basis for my numbers in my June 24 report. In view of the disparity between DRNR collections and needs, and the recent charges by six mid-level Alyeska employees that senior executives on the pipeline are actively squelching whistleblowers and are receiving no relief from state and federal monitors, environmental and public interest groups have called for independent audit of the pipeline in connection with the merger. That's item number three of the new information. Yesterday, I heard a credible report that BP, this is a rumor, but I believe my sources are good, that BP is negotiating this week in Houston to sell 72% of the pipeline to an independent buyer for a guarantee of low future tariffs.
I like the guarantee of low future tariffs.
Yes. However, I am concerned, and I bring this rumor to you in this form, this unconfirmed report, because I recall that ARCO and BP spent fully 3 months perfecting their takeover plan before they informed us of their plans on March the 29th. Therefore, I would like to know if the state is a party to or monitoring these negotiations if they are taking place. Among the concerns are the treatment of DRNR and lease renewal and whether the request for low tariffs, however we and BP might desire it, might violate either common carrier or antitrust laws. Again, it's going to be harder to pick up later if, in fact, this report is valid. In conclusion, I'd like to make three quick points. Number one, I encourage careful research on your part. The 1999 reports of Professor James Smith of SMU and his colleague Liebkap to the National Bureau of Economic Research flatly refutes and reveals as absurd the assertion you heard today that AOGCC has sufficient authority to protect Alaska's interests. Number two, the FTC has made it clear again today that Alaska's situation, as Professors Fisher and Kahn have outlined, Jim Sykes and others, our situation and problems are unique, and FTC may not have statutory authority to deal with them. Number three, then, in conclusion, time flies and we are not having fun. I encourage this committee to take immediate and vigorous action to ensure that Alaska's interests are protected. And I was obviously mistaken that we're not having fun. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? If not, okay. Tom Lakish?
Tom Lockish, thank you very much.
Excuse me for the mispronunciation.
No problem, everybody. I've got a few charts here I'd like to return. I'll give you a copy of the complete paper. I've only got three copies here. But this is just, I've taken a different tack at looking at this. And from the transshipment point of view regarding tanker replacement, pursuant to OPA 90 provisions and through the monopolistic control of supply to the West Coast through the vapor recovery system at the berth, BP has already exerted its monopolistic control and created the present budget crisis that we're now enduring and having to deal with. As you may know, vapor recovery was put on
two berths, three, four and five at the terminal VMT, and berths one and three remain uncontrolled. Well, it turns out that BP's puppet Alyeska promised that it would, and their other shippers promised that they'd be able to ship 1.1 million barrels per day at the control berths, and that they were given an exemption for loading uncontrolled at berths one and three to meet the Department of Revenue projections for 98, 99, and 2000. The 98 allowance was 2.75 thousand barrels per day. 99 was 205 thousand barrels per day, and the year 2000 was over 100 something thousand barrels per day. Well, it turns out that they've only been loading total uncontrolled and controlled approximately 1.03 million barrels per day. And they've been refusing to load at the uncontrolled berths. Now, initially, this might seem to be an altruistic reason to prevent air pollution, but in fact, if that was the case, they put the controls on berth three and have controlled loading at three berths instead. So what essentially has been happening here is that BP has been controlling the West Coast market supply by refusing to load their tankers, by not replacing the tankers that have been retired. And as a matter of fact, they refused to service Alaska with tankers that were not yet required to be retired under Open 90. There was three boats. If you look at that chart there, that's been sent to the governor. I'll tell you about the problem with the governor in a little bit. But I want to get to the meat of the issue here, is how BP's further monopolistic control is an antitrust action and must be prohibited by law. You'll look at the tanker retirement schedule, and this is just retired tankers. This isn't all tankers. And it goes between 98 and 2007. Well, actually, I think the latest one on here is 2007, the Arco Alaska. Oh, no, 8, Arco California. There's a question mark. There's a Southern Lion, a Northern Lion, and the Western Lion. And the Eastern Lion has also mysteriously disappeared. Apparently, from information supplied by DEC and RCAC, that they took those out of the tanker fleet because they didn't want to bring in extra spill response equipment to meet the response planning standard for these very large tankers. So here are these three or four large vessels that were to be retired this year anyway, but they took them out of service, and therefore we haven't been able to ship our oil. And so this is why you have a budget shortfall. Not because the price was low, it's because they didn't want to ship the oil. And they're not replacing the tankers. They didn't replace those tankers, and they canceled plans with NASSCO 1 week before they announced the merger. They had planned to compete with ARCO on their Millennium-class tankers for the green customers on the West Coast. And they designed and were developing what they call the Cape-class tankers with NASSCO in San Diego. Well, a week before the merger, all of a sudden the option to build those three Cape-class tankers disappeared. Now, my sources in ARCO tell me that it would cost them more to cancel the three Millennium-class tankers than to finish them, or they probably would have done that as well. They've probably shredded the designs to the Millennium-class tankers, which are better than the Cape-class tankers. So you have two forms of anti-competitive actions here. First, they're not building the quantity of tankers that would meet the free trade requirement. Second, they're stifling innovation and quality competition. Because, first of all, the Cape class aren't as good as the Millennium class. The Cape class only have 6-foot double hulls. The Millennium class have 10-foot double hulls. The Cape class doesn't have the 3,000 horsepower bow thrusters that the Millennium class does, and now we don't have the Cape class at all because they have a merger now. And a BP executive told me, "Oh well, we just bought three tankers in a fire sale." And so here we have a situation where they know that they have to have these tankers. If you'll see the dates, the years that they're replacing, and what I've considered to be millennium equivalents, and what I would think would be at the minimum amount of construction schedule, that they have to produce not only BP's replacement tankers, but ARCO's replacement tankers now, which in equivalence is approximately 20 tankers. You know, I proposed building at least 14 of them by 2007 because of possible reduction in throughput, but that's only an estimate that I've got because I don't really know the turnaround times yet. And what we need to get out in the public and what has to be asked for by this committee to be made public is, in fact, what I had asked the governor. And which he refused to answer. He handed it off to Larry Dietrich in D.C. to answer my question about construction schedule for tankers. I asked the governor, please indicate which tankers are replaced, the design of the replacement tanker, the distance between the double hulls, the number of shafts, number of rudders, the number of independent engine rooms, bow thruster and horsepower, navigation system design, and tanker size and displacement. You know, this is a very long lead time. Not only does it take at least 2 years once you start construction, but they've got to line up all of these yards. Everybody's replacing tankers now because of Open 90, and if those yards aren't lined up, we're in big trouble. We can't ship anything. And from the past practices, their refusal to load at uncontrolled berths and the refusal to place to take tankers out of trade before their retirement date, and the refusal to replace them now means that they have total control over our budget. And you're going to let them go ahead and I'm trying to find a delicate word here, control Alaskan's economy inappropriately in an anti-competitive and monopolistic manner. And Harry's assurances are just as much bovine detritus as anything, because in fact, if they were going to agree with your requests, that they would have already made this stuff public, all of these issues public. They're not making them public. BP is not going to roll over because you express Alaska's interest. They haven't provided the information. They refuse to give you the information unless you kept it secret. And so I'm beside myself on how this is going. The letter from Larry Dietrich in response to my letter to the governor, which I'll give you a copy of, and my letter to the Washington State AG, clearly will look like a BP advertisement in the paper. It was absolutely ridiculous. He says, "Oh, don't worry about the tankers that were retired. They're already gone." Well, where are their replacements? How come we can't ship oil? How come we can't meet the Department of Revenue projected throughput? How come they're refusing to load tankers? How come they're refusing to put vapor controls on the berth so they can be the environmental green oil company of the world like John Brown says? Hogwash. They're refusing to do this. Now, Bill Britt has heard my appeal, and Ms. Cartula, Representative Cartula here, was their counsel when I tried to get them to enforce the DNR lease with regard to contingency plan. It was regarding the Valdez Marine Terminal contingency plan that was originally submitted in August of 93. There are still outstanding conditions of appeal on what has not been approved essentially completely since August of 93. And both Bill Britt and the commissioner have refused to enforce the lease. You folks should be talking about forfeiting the lease under Article 8, Section 8. Not granting them blessing their merger. In fact, here, and I would hope that you would all read Dr. Fisher's analysis of Article 8 and Governor Egan's statement about fish traps and how that industry had controlled Alaska economy and politics, and that's why Article 8 was written the way it was. You've got to protect our natural resources, both the mineral resources, oil resources, and the natural resources that we all have the right to reasonably concurrently use. And I am extremely distressed. The pipeline contingency plan was similarly delayed. It still has outstanding conditions of approval. I just got today, as a matter of fact, a copy to look at of the new Valdez Marine Terminal contingency plan, and that is more fictitious paper of indeterminate use. And so I don't understand how you can let them put ARCO out of business, which is the only company that went to the effort to protect our natural resources here by designing and putting into construction the Millennium Class tankers. If ARCO would have went forward, if ARCO Marine were to stay as it is, then we would have 10 Millennium-class tankers at least. Now we're only going to have 3 and no Cape-class tankers because they don't need to compete with ARCO for green customers on the West Coast anymore. ARCO's gone. They're going to shred those designs. And we really need to have a specific tanker construction schedule, and we have to have the data on turnaround times for those tankers. Because you know, we can't have a budget unless we ship our oil. And, I mean, this isn't saying that they couldn't manipulate and monopolistically control the production, you know, end of it, or the throughput on the pipeline, but it's clear that they're already doing it at the terminal and with the tankers. And you guys got to look at this not only from the merger point, but what, even if you don't let them merge, how they're manipulating the throughput on the pipeline and our income by refusing to load tankers and not replacing their tankers to provide shipment, even if they still only have 51%. I've been negotiating. I've been after these guys for years now, as Representative Cantula will tell you that this is a continuous daily debate to get the types of protections that were guaranteed under law. And it's their lobbying and their efforts that have prohibited the use of the best available technology in all up and down the line. The controlling the interest, not only state interest in the DNR, but also at the federal level, BLM. Both DNR and BLM had a requirement to have annual contingency plan reviews in the lease and the grant. We haven't seen one for 7 years, a full review in 7 years of the terminal, or really even the pipeline review isn't complete because of the contingency plans. DNR refused to do it at all. BLM is sitting on their thumbs. And so, you know, this lease renewal has to be looked at closely. The merger has to be looked at closely. And if we're going to have BP control through ATC, all of the tankers in the fleet, we have to know that we get the quality that ARCO set as a standard, and in numbers of to allow not only the projected throughput, but all other throughput that may come along, given these no decline in 99 commitments and commitments to have additional development and production. And this has to, we have to see those contracts with those shipyards, because if they don't do them now, we won't have those tankers. We will not be able to sell diddly squat unless you're going to be out there with a bucket trying to sell it on the street corner. That isn't quite going to work. Thank you very much for your time.
Questions?
I have. Well, you've obviously been involved in this a lot longer, in more detail than I have. If it is the lack of tanker space and using the right berths has decreased the amount of oil that's got to the market, what have they decreased? The input of the pipeline, or build a bigger tank farm?
They had to slow down the pipeline and slow down production because the tanks in the tank farm that they didn't complete, that we were promised 10 more tanks in the farm. that we never got, and or at least eight that I know of. And so they fill up. There's no tankers to put them in. And they're refusing to go to the damn, excuse my expression, berth to load their tankers. And so they have to slow down production. That means for every day that they slow down production, that's that many dollars less we have that year to spend. And that's, and it's not just hurting us in the pocket, but it's raising the price down in California to $1.73. You know, Lord knows who set the fire in the refinery.
Let's see, is Laura Walden? Apparently not here still. Resurrection Drive.
I would say this is a complete one.
Okay, we don't have anyone else signed up to testify. Is there further business to come before the committee? Duke, we don't have another sign up sheet back there, Julie? Okay. Well, with that, the public testimony portion is over. Thank you. We don't have another scheduled meeting. We will schedule one in August sometime. Are there times when people won't be available? Might be the better way to approach it. Okay.
I'm available.
Okay. We will get back to everybody. Thank you for your participation, and thank you all for your participation. We are adjourned.